Hey, good morning. Welcome to FinTechla, the podcast brought to you by the National University of Singapore and US FinTech Lab. I will be your host for this series. My name is Jung Pil Han. I'm a faculty member here at the NUS School of Computing, and I'm joined with
Nicholas Garcia. I'm also a co-director of the NUS FinTech Lab and a faculty member here at National University of Singapore.
All right. So this is actually a pilot episode. So we're just starting out and seeing how things go. But we wanted to talk today. We'll have a discussion today, have a conversation about some of the new technological developments that's really revolutionizing, I guess, or creating a lot of hype in all sectors, but including the financial services sector, which is AI, and more particularly generative AI, which became very popular since late last year with OpenAI's ChatGPT. So Nicholas, have you been using ChatGPT?
Oh, I have. I've been using it quite a bit, actually. I feel it's a great way to analyze lots of text in a short amount of time and generate some good news.
So what, you know, we don't need to, I think everybody's heard of, you know, GPT, actually used it because it's one of these technologies that's gaining great momentum and popularity because of the ease of use. You can just log in, you have a free account, you know, you have access to GPT 3.5, you know, you have to pay to get GPT-4, the more advanced model, but you still, GPT 3.5 is still very impressive. Mm-hmm. And it's the user friendliness. You can just type in a prompt, write in a question, copy paste some text and ask it to do something, summarize this text, you know, rephrase this, make it a bit more, you know, sound more authoritative. So it's very easy to interact with this technology. And it's producing such human-like responses that it's, you know, really gaining, you know, or kind of creating a lot of excitement among the people here. So, Nicholas, so what have you heard from like our industry partners in the financial services industry about their plans on whether or not they want to adopt this technology, or, you know, how they're planning on using this? Have you heard anything?
We've heard from industry that there's actually quite a lot of excitement about where can this be used in all different sectors of the company. Of course, most of the financial industries that we're looking at are a bit more conservative, so they're looking at more narrow applications of operations efficiency improvements instead of necessarily leapfrogging into new strategic areas with this new technology.
But have we actually seen like real use cases with this technology? Again, it's very new. A lot of companies are experimenting with it, but what are some specific use cases where this technology has been used or been proven to be extremely useful for like banks?
From our specific industry partners, one thing that we found to be relatively interesting was that similar to the way that Google search would help you surface interesting links, within the company's intranet, they were beginning to use some kind of customized version of ChatGPT to help query what kind of query information that was perhaps buried in different PDFs around the company's intranet, and then provide actual links, helping to get around this potential for hallucination that ChatGPT has become known for in recent months. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I kind of sense or fear is a slight misplacing of our excitement about generative AI in companies. If you're doing like what you just mentioned, you know, going through a lot of these PDF or any kind of documents, going through documents, extracting insights, you know, creating, you know, new knowledge or at least extracting interesting facts from documents that people may have missed. I think that's, you know, here generative AI can be used as a formidable tool to be able to do that. But wouldn't companies or corporations actually try to use this technology to systematize or create systems that actually create, you know, operations and, you know, generate operational efficiencies, not just as a tool? It's not like we're giving Microsoft Word or a word processor to employees so that they can create or you know, create documents in a much more easier manner or quicker, not as a tool, but as a system.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. So on the spectrum of automation, of course, we have the kind of ad hoc tool use that individuals might kind of take part in just to improve their own, you know, workflow. But we've gotten access to companies who are using this to systematize say their email responses to different clients, both internally and externally. And so because it's very multimodal, it's able to read text, it's able to read documents and craft some kind of responses that provide some kind of human in the loop to check whether or not it's valid or not, and then quickly increase their efficiencies by up to 25% in terms of responding to emails. Mm-hmm. We've also seen areas in customer service, such as on the phone lines, helping customers be rerouted to the specific things that they're worried about without having to go through quite so many steps, by having a little bit more of a human-like back and forth that still gets you from point A to point B quickly. And if there is an actual employee on the line for customer service, then the chatbot that's listening in or the large language model that's listening in is able to quickly kind of give feedback to the human employee while the conversation is happening. And the feedback can be both in terms of documents that are relevant to help facilitate the conversation, perhaps the client's looking for, or other kinds of feedback of how to tailor their conversation to the particular customer or prospect if it's mm-hmm. sales.
No, I really think the idea or the notion of human in the loop is very important here, right? Because we know this technology is still pretty much a black box, right? We cannot predict or contain its hallucinations. It could hallucinate and give you wrong answers or wrong data, wrong insights. And having the human in the loop is kind of a safeguard against, let's say, giving faulty advice to your clients, so on and so forth. But because, you know, the level of hallucination or the extent of hallucination may be, you know, in the beginning may be pretty high, where the human in the loop, the person overseeing or being assisted by this technology, would actually make sound judgments about whether or not, you know, to accept recommendations from the AI. But over time, I'm pretty sure, you know, the accuracy is going to get better, but, you know, we're not going to reduce hallucination to like zero. That's probably not going to happen, despite our best efforts. And so in that case, as kind of the accuracy of AI enhances, the human in the loop, is there a danger of the human in the loop becoming a rubber stamper and really not thinking about it? So in most cases, it's, you know, the AI decision or the recommendation is correct. And so if you repeat, you know, reading through and say, okay, this looks good, okay, I accept, let's do this, and actually kind of just approve the decisions made by AI, right? And if that's like out of 100 cases, 99 times you're going to approve, but just for that one time where it might hallucinate or you might disagree with the recommendations, if you disapprove, in that kind of context, is there a fear or a danger of the human becoming just a rubber stamper and just losing that, you know, the actual intent of having the human in the loop just disappearing, just being not effective because of, you know, the general nature of how work gets done?
I think that's a really interesting point, Jean-Paul. I think based on, if we kind of tried to look at different analogies of what we've seen taking place in the real world, perhaps less in fintech specifically, where AI is being used and we do have humans in the loop to be, you know, so-called rubber stamper, we do see examples from high-risk cases such as radiology, where people are trying to detect perhaps tumors in different images. And this was seen as a place where AI could come in and really give a lot of benefits to doctors. And it turns out that by having AI as an element to hopefully speed up the work, it actually creates a lot of consternation for doctors, because at the current stage of where the AI is at, it may not be able to explain what it's doing very well. And I think even though we have these AI models, such as generative language models, that have the ability to act like they are explaining their reasoning, I think the current stage of these generative language models, their explanations might be post hoc rationalizations of what they've priorly kind of decided, or even cause them to kind of re-reason it. And so the human in the loop kind of probably can be, even if, especially in a high risk case where there's a lot on the line, kind of arguing with the machine or having more dialogue with the machine. So that's something we're trying to see in AI in general, this ability for interpretability through dialogue with the machine. But well, I think one fear we have of the current version of AI, generative AI, is that it doesn't necessarily know why it came to the solutions that it came to. So there are some people and researchers trying to kind of create systems where the AI will be trained to think more logically and more rigorously, even if it is a large language model.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's a very interesting, I think there's two interesting points there. First, you know, it could depend on, you know, the kind of task you're involved in, but is radiology and reading, diagnosing x-rays kind of the same thing as, you know, customer service calls in a bank, right? Mm. And so, you know, radiologists have years of training, they have very deep expertise, right? And so there's a lot of tacit knowledge involved in their tasks. Whereas, you know, just again, you know, if you have a wealth management advisor, yes, you will have deep expertise, but a lot of the use cases in which generative AI or chatbots are being implemented are probably in more of the broader, you know, mass market customer service, mm-hmm. where not that much expertise is really required, mm-hmm. or, you know, there might be some nuances, but right. And so whether or not buying AI in those contexts where the human in the loop does have strong views mm-hmm. about what's right, what's wrong, and can question the recommendations given mm-hmm. by AI mm-hmm. may be more effective mm-hmm. in a more natural, emergent and kind of organic sense, mm-hmm. rather than, you know, just putting customers, you know, AI within the customer service context, chatbot mm-hmm. context, where, you know, there's not a whole lot of expertise. I don't, you know, there's insecurities about what I know. You know, these, a lot of times these are entry level employees, not a whole lot of experiences. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, does the context matter? So that's one thing, you know, if you can respond to that first or have some ideas about that.
Mm. I think that definitely, yeah, if we're talking about maybe more entry level things where, or, you know, things where the AI is being used purely for automation to auto-generate responses, and the kind of the context you talk about where it might be more rubber stamping. One thing I would worry about is that if we're a human person who's responsible for being the human in the loop has to overview so many different AIs and like finally check each one of them very rapidly, we might reach a kind of point of cognitive overload of the human checker as well. And it kind of brings to mind if the human's cognitive overloaded, might there be an AI checking other AIs? And we actually do hear that some people in OpenAI are using large amounts of their compute to create different AI, essentially researchers alongside the researchers that they have on staff to help them run the experiments and kind of check the performance of other AI models. So I think it might be, if we're kind of thinking farther into the future, we might see real AI agents supervising other AI agents in interesting ways.
So the second point that you bring up, another point that I want to bring up a little later, if I don't forget. The second point related to transparency and explainability, especially because, you know, in the European Union, the AI Act is currently being looked over. And one of the things that's kind of salient in there is that depending on the risk levels and you know, financial services, would most financial service use cases or applications of AI therein would be considered high risk cases, mm-hmm. because it deals with people's livelihoods, right? And so in those cases, there's a very strong requirement for transparency and explainability, mm-hmm. right? Based on our previous discussion, would financial service institutions or banks be able to, you know, actually ensure that kind of explainability with these black box models? Is that going to be a big hindrance?
I think one thing that we're looking at when we look at the research of AI explainability is that there's, of course, a spectrum of how simple or how complex you want the explanation to be. So if you're talking to regulators, do you want to make sure that the model itself is like finely explained? I think one area that we will see generative AI or language models assisting this is there is a desire amongst the explainability research community to have abilities for the human beings to kind of have a dialogue and interrogate models that maybe themselves are not language models, but maybe the language model can act as an interstitial layer, as a layer to kind of facilitate the querying of how exactly the underlying financial algorithm is making decisions. And I believe that this might be a good advancement for the interpretability of non-generative AI models. Mm. Jungpil, thank you for, you know, asking me so many questions, but I wanted to turn around to you some of the thoughts that we've been having. One of the things that we mentioned here was this potential for AIs to interact with other AIs, including in this kind of agential manner, where it's not just a single query giving a single input, but rather a kind of iterative, almost a lifelike presence. Do you have any thoughts of the potentially unintended consequences of this kind of a development of AI?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. And there's been some recent work. I don't remember the authors, but there's a recent paper that actually talked about, you know, AI producing, you know, new training data, AI generating training data for AI to train itself and become better, and having that kind of, you know, like a feedback cycle. And what they found was that, you know, AI starts learning gibberish, right? And they call that, you know, model collapse, right? And so AI will produce data that it thinks is good for training, but then it learns, and then based on its learning will produce more data. And so it goes into this vicious cycle, not a virtuous cycle, but a vicious cycle where this might happen. There was also an interesting study from one of our NUS School of Computing undergraduate students last semester. What was her name? Eugene Lim. And I was the examiner. And so, you know, assistant professor Aditya Karanam was the supervisor for that project. And she did a really interesting study where she was looking at algorithmic pricing, right, or dynamic pricing, and used kind of a reinforcement learning model for pricing, where you have a duopoly, two firms are competing on, you know, for market demand, like a hotel would do dynamic pricing and see realized demand. And looked at whether or not how, just if we let algorithms do pricing, what would be the eventual outcome. In most of the cases, it led to collusion, right? And so, you know, we know that collusion's kind of illegal, but current kind of laws state that there has to be intent. There has to be some explicit discussion about, you know, hey, let's collude, right? And let's try to manipulate the market. You know, it's illegal because it's bad for consumers, right? Because you get a monopoly in a duopoly setting. But it just leads to an unintended collusion environment where there's no, it's not even tacit collusion. There's no intent to collude, but the best strategic response is to collude. Mm-hmm. Well, it looks like collusion because you're setting higher prices than the Nash equilibrium. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are these kinds of unintended consequences that may arise because we really don't understand how AI actually kind of reacts to other, how AI reacts. You know, there's one thing about reacting to human input, you know, in a one-off kind of conversational sense. But when you accelerate that, with AI interacting with an AI, right? And that becomes very quick, right? And then, you know, they are pushing each other to test the limits, and they can find like things, you know, different regimes of, you know, strategies that actually could be very harmful. But we don't really understand, you know, the range of kind of outcomes, unintended outcomes that this might provide. So it's very dangerous. I think we need to be very cautious about that when we talk, you know, these days when we talk about, you know, AI adoption within companies. A lot of the kind of the storytelling or the discussion is focused around how a company might benefit from AI. But there's not a whole lot of discussion about what if everybody adopts AI, all companies in that industry all adopt AI and do the same thing. Like GPT or ChatGPT or, you know, Bard or whatever, generative AI is actually accessible to everybody. The same foundational model. Yes, you may customize it with your own data. And that could, you know, offer some opportunities for customization and differentiation. But for the most part, they will, you know, these models are trained on, you know, orders of magnitude more data than what your company has internally, right? And so most of its learning, most of its knowledge, I presume, would be very generic, right? When you have, when everybody has access to the same technology, this is like, you know, ATMs for banks, right? It used to be having an ATM was a, you know, a source of strategic or competitive advantage, but now it's a strategic liability. If you don't have an ATM, you can't compete, right? Are we going to end up with that where maybe, you know, the customers are better off because they get better service, but in the end, you know, the firms aren't really, you know, helping, or AI is not really helping firms to become more competitive and actually win, you know, the competition.
Yeah, I think that's definitely an interesting question that we'll see, you know, as the years unfold. If we're going to put on our theory hats a little bit and try to predict from what has happened in the past, this does remind me quite a bit of a debate, I think, with Eric Brynjolfsson. He tried to settle it about IT in general and whether or not investments in IT would produce kind of strategic advantages to firms, or whether or not, due to your point, it was available to all the firms, that it was just not really a differentiator. And so early versions of this research did show that, to exactly your point, the IT investments did not seem to produce strategic advantages. But as they looked at longer and longer time scales, they did see that the firms that did invest more in IT, of course, it started more in automation of existing processes. It started did not start necessarily with more creative kind of uses of it. But once these you had higher investments in IT in different firms, and we can kind of use AI as an analogy to this, once you have more things that are automated in more kind of flexible ways with AI, perhaps we will see new inventive capabilities being spun off. And maybe we'll see these coming from our fully digital banks, or because you're allowing people to essentially hire the equivalent, I think to some extent, I think of these AI models as essentially as good as 20-year-old college students in terms of like their capability. Sometimes they don't have high expertise, but they have like some general knowledge. If you could hire all of these 20-year-old college students for free and have them work 1,000 times faster than a real college student, then or essentially free, then you might have all these firms kind of popping up here and there doing interesting things that the banks themselves might be a little bit hesitant to do because of all of these regulations and high risk of managing people's wealth. But we might see a lot of innovation that slowly gets integrated into the firm from the outside, or if they have these high investments inside the firm, they might have intrapreneurs who find creative solutions to deal with all of the data they have. But I think before our talk, you mentioned something about the data that banks do seem to be ingesting, and whether or not that would be even feasible to use within the AI context, or also the question of how much data in these models should be coming from the bank versus from external vendors that are building the models in the first place.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned, I like the analogy of AI being like the free 20-year-old college graduate, which is kind of right. AI, we kind of use the analogy of a very obedient child, right? It will absorb everything. It will, it's very obedient. You tell it exactly what you want it to do and it will do it. Like, technology is kind of like that. But then when we do have, with AI at least, not other technologies thus far, but with AI, because of the allure of intelligence, if not intelligence, is that, yes, they can be used to substitute like our entry level, at least at this stage, entry level employees, like workforce. Mm-hmm. That's a huge concern, right? Now, for we're currently at the National University of Singapore, where we're like educating undergraduate students, mm-hmm. that, and we're talking about them not becoming relevant or needed in industry. How should we think about that kind of pipeline? Do we really want to create an environment where our educated students don't have a place to go now because AI is better than them? They don't take vacations. They don't take sick leaves. They don't, you don't have to pay them. Well, you have to pay for electricity, I guess, but probably much cheaper. It's much more scalable than human beings. Human beings are much more cantankerous. They will complain. They will, create other office politics. AI won't do that. Mm-hmm. So, where's the future? This talk about all this discussion about job displacement, it's real, especially with AI, not other technology. I think this is much more real, and it needs to be taken into consideration. I think the pursuit of efficiency, pursuit of innovation is formidable and is admirable. But at the same time, is this what we really want or need as a society?
Mm. I mean, it's a little bit hard to kind of know what's going to happen 50 or 100 years from now, but we do have some data. It might not be relevant to GDP era, but it's because it was gathered earlier, some data that shows that in this kind of destructive, creative destruction kind of context, AI does seem to be the job category. This is research from Rob Siemens in NYU. Yeah. The percent of a job task that can overlap with an AI, whether it be manual or visual or language tasks, the greater percent of a job task that is automated, we actually see increasing wages and increasing hiring of people in these jobs. And I think the logic behind that is that the more tedious parts of the task can be automated, mm-hmm. and then the more creative or agile parts need to be can be done by the human, increasing their productivity and thus wages and potentially even employment numbers. I think in terms of entry level and students, we will hopefully see, you know, the AI will also be available to them. And so if they're able to, quote unquote, supervise their own kind of cohort of people, this will hopefully help them level up their own kind of creative thinking and think at what are the edge cases, think more creatively, where can this be applied, and less being used for these rote tasks that the AI itself can produce. And I think another point about automation in general is that you probably can automate anything, but there's a cost to tailor your automation to the task. And there has to be a certain value that the task is providing you for having automated. And so I think the human in the loop responsibility is to A, decide if a task needs to be automated. And if so, go through the actual kind of trial and error process to make the automation work and make it kind of less error prone, all of these things, deal with the side risks and benefits. So I do think that even our young people will have a place in this future economy, even if they are, in a sense, managing some of these more AI tools that are coming out.
No, I hope, you know, I don't want to be, you know, too end of the world scenario, you know, planning kind of person. But I think it does push us, at least, you know, educators like ourselves, mm-hmm. to think about what are the skill sets that we need to kind of inculcate in our students at this mm-hmm. day and age, to get them ready for the workforce in this kind of new workforce era where AI will be pervasive, mm-hmm. right? And again, you know, ChatGPT has only been out end of last year. So mm-hmm. it's been less than a year, mm-hmm. and it's creating so much disruption and excitement and disruption in the industry. And so, you know, the pace of change is extremely rapid. Mm-hmm. But are universities set up to, you know, be adaptive to that pace of change? That's it's our homework.
Well, I know you've definitely been on a lot of panels kind of discussing this. Do you have any kind of crowdsourced of theories from around Singapore?
Oh, no, it's a challenge that we're all dealing with. I think a lot of the universities, you know, in Singapore, even in US, mm-hmm. is, you know, grappling with the issue of how to, you know, incorporate things like ChatGPT into the curriculum, into mm-hmm. our learning environment. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been some universities around the world, like I think in Australia, that actually banned the use of ChatGPT or mm-hmm. went back to just, you know, no more like essay type homeworks. You're going to do like, you know, in-class paper and pencil mm-hmm. Exams only. Mm-hmm. I think that's a move, kind of a retro move backward, right? Mm-hmm. At NUS, you know, I think the thinking and the strategy from universities, you know, the provost office, is that we need to embrace this technology and try to create an environment where students learn with the technology, learn better, become better, better equipped with the technology in the domains that they're interested in. And so, mm-hmm. you know, at least the directive that we currently have is that we shouldn't ban it. We should mm-hmm. leverage it. There's a lot of initiatives here at NUS Computing where, you know, a lot of our lecturers are actually experimenting with different ways to incorporate ChatGPT mm-hmm. into our mm-hmm. curriculum. I think, mm-hmm. you know, we'll see some results of that, and hopefully in some future podcasts, we'll talk about that as well. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really, we need to experiment and try to figure out how best to use this and how, you know, equip our students with the latest knowledge and experiences and technology so that they will be ready for that world. So hopefully the investment that we put in there will pan out, you know, mm-hmm. but fingers crossed.
Yeah, definitely a lot of challenges to know how the world will adapt. One thing that I wanted to touch on that you've been kind of mentioning throughout this hour is this potential for unintended consequences or risks. And of course, this is something that is in the mind of the public, you know, going all the way back to the Terminator films. But even to today, we see open letters from many, many AI scientists being penned saying that AI, you know, has as big of a risk to the world as nuclear war. We see other people commenting on this kind of posturing, saying perhaps it will just be creating a regulatory moat for those who are already advanced enough in this field to keep out all competitors so that they can essentially monopolize the use of this, the creation of this technology and the sale of this technology. Do you have any thoughts either on the safety front or on the potential centralization and monopolization front of this technology? And both maybe also thinking from a global perspective, because a lot of the technology does come from the USA. So if we think kind of globally, is there any other kind of elements there that we should take into account?
Oh, that's opening up a huge can of worms. There's a lot of discussion going on right now with respect to technology regulation, you know, how best to approach. And again, you know, there's some It's very difficult because, you know, the regulation process is very slow, has to be thought through very carefully from many different perspectives. And, you know, the world is just changing too quickly right now, right? There are some key ideas, for example, requiring that these models or these companies have to open their systems for greater transparency, right? For auditing. Right. And so that would be very, you know, uncomfortable for these technology companies where, you know, I have to open up my model.
I think for now, though, the models oftentimes are the architectures, at least, are published, about oftentimes are open source, but just they might not publish the trillion parameters that they're using for it.
Yeah. Well, it's not just the parameters, but, you know, somehow some way of opening up the model so that they can be questioned, audited. To really, you know, check through, right? Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the times, you know, even not just these, you know, AI technologies, but a lot of technologies used in banks, they're not open to the outside, to regulators, right? Well, they might request, you know, this kind of data, that kind of data, or, you know, be able to go in. But because of this fast-changing environment, you know, kind of a requirement to have these models open where it can be observed, academics can go in and study. I think that kind of new way of thinking about kind of the regulatory regime, because the technology changes so fast. If you define it too specifically, you're going to, you know, it's going to be outdated like in 3 days. Right? If you define it too generally, then it won't apply anywhere. And so there's a sweet spot somewhere, which, you know, nobody knows where that sweet spot is. And so I think a different kind of perspective about how to minimize the risks, right? We don't want to regulate. You just have, you know, a laundry list of stuff you can do, you cannot do. That's probably that's not the right approach.
Right.
And so just a risk minimization approach is probably the current thinking in AI regulation right now. And, you know, we'll see more developments. You know, the AI Act from the EU, the US is, you know, the Department of Commerce is also considering, you know, AI regulation. And so, you know, Singapore is also doing the same thing. So there'll be a lot of developments coming up very soon. So let's wait and see. I think, you know, I think we're running out of time. And so I hope this discussion was, at least this pilot episode, got us thinking, you know, it's very awkward to be, you know, talking like this in front of a mic. Hopefully we'll get more natural and better over time. But if you have any questions, please feel free to write to us. Our email is fintech@compnusedusg. We hope to get your comments, feedback, suggestions for future, you know, discussion topics, so on and so forth. So, you know, we would love to interact with you through those channels.